Welcome to Book Waves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Steve Earle, who has a novel, I'll Never Get Out of This World Alive. Steve Earle also has a collection of short stories, Doghouse, Roses. Steve Earle is a singer, songwriter, composer, 14 albums to his credit, 14 Grammy nominations, started with Guitar Town 1986, and the most recent album is I'll Never Get Out of This World Alive, which was recently released. Steve Earle, I'll Never Get Out of This World Alive, the album apparently has thematic connections to the book. So before we get into the details on the book itself, why did you choose to name the album after the book?
The book was named after a Hank Williams song. The book was always going to be called I'll Never Get Out of This World Alive. And from the minute I figured out what the book was going to be about, that was the title. And that's usual with me. Most of my albums over the years, I've known what they were called pretty early in the process of putting the songs together. My editor, after I published Doghouse Roses, was basically trying to find a way to trick me into writing a novel because editors, the last thing they want to see from a writer that's just published a collection of short fiction is another collection of short fiction. So he was trying to find a way to get me to commit to writing a full-length novel. He knew my favorite book was a book called Coming Through Slaughter, which is Michael Ondaatje's first novel. I've always loved it because it's sort of a form of literature that's only existed a few times because Michael was a poet and it was his first, you know, foray into prose. And it's like on the road and a handful of other things before it, a poet writing prose and it coming out as poetic as that does, you know, when, before they start trying too hard to write novels. And Coming Through Slaughter is about Buddy Bolden, who was a legendary cornet player in New Orleans at the turn of the last century. He lived into the 40s, but he became insane, evidently, and never made recordings that really represented him at the height of his powers as a player. So we don't know what Buddy Bolden sounded like, but we know what Louis Armstrong and a lot of his contemporaries sound like, and they certainly heard Buddy Bolden. So legend has it that Buddy Bolden disappeared for 30 days in 1909, and Coming Through Slaughter is basically a speculation on Michael's part of that, what happened during those 30 days. So Anton Mueller, my editor at the time, basically suggested that I find some legend that surrounds my day job, and there are some, you know, being a singer-songwriter that lived in Nashville for 33 years, to wrap some fiction around. And I'd always heard that there was a doctor traveling with Hank Williams when he died, and that when they actually called the police in West Virginia and found him dead in the back seat of his own Cadillac, that the doctor was supposedly there, according to several accounts, when they left Knoxville, which was the last place Hank was seen alive. But when the police came, there were only two people in the car, the driver, who was a college student, had been hired for the weekend, and Hank. So that idea just sort of interested me, and I knew some people that knew a lot about Hank and other people that had written books, and Marty Stewart's a friend of mine. He has a large collection of country music memorabilia, including a letter from this gentleman called Toby Marshall, who is, I found, the doctor, in quotation marks, that was traveling with Hank when he died, or may have been traveling with Hank. Now, as it turns out, Toby Marshall was not a physician at all. He never was. He was a quack who claimed that he could treat alcoholism with chlorohydrate. And you know, I guess it kind of worked because you can't drink if you're dead. It's a very, very strong barbiturate. And I think Hank's mother, from everything I've seen, basically found out about Toby Marshall and got him involved in Hank's life. So by the time I got down to actually writing the book in earnest and doing the research, I'd already been banging around the idea of this doctor who was, maybe he was an addict, maybe he'd lost his license because he was an addict. And the idea of him having been an MD at some point in his life was more interesting to me than the real Toby Marshall. And so I took off from there and abandoned Toby Marshall as a character and took off with started creating this new character who was indeed a doctor.
When you first began looking around, did the Williams story just jump out at you before all others?
I'm a singer-songwriter that lived in Nashville for 33 years. If you tried to do that job in Nashville, it's hard not to be haunted by Hank Williams. I'll Never Get Out of This World Alive became the title almost instantly as soon as I started. It's the last single that Hank released while he was alive, and it went number one the week after he died, and it just sort of presents a natural title.
Did you start writing something involving the quack doctor as a character?
No, I had actually started the opposite. I started writing... I'm really busy and have this other job that I do as a singer-songwriter. I tour. I also wrote a play in the interim and produced it. So I basically had been writing without doing a ton of research and ideas would pop into my head, so I would go to the computer and put them in there and, you know, back them up. The first things I wrote were Hank sections. There are sections that in the final form of their italicized and in present tense that are sort of just other reality that sort of pops up early in the book, especially when Hank's around. And it sort of happens when Doc's high, which are sort of the same time in the beginning of the book. That's also patterned after Coming Through Slaughter. It has a couple of different voices in it like that.
And the timing of it, 1963, November 1963, at what point did you decide that that would be...
Totally arbitrary, 10 years, nice round number, 10 years after Hank died. You know, they say write what you know. San Antonio, Texas is where I grew up. 1963, I arrived at that number just by math. And then, okay, what happened in 1963 in San Antonio? Well, on November 21st, 1963, I was at this airport in San Antonio, Texas, because my father was an air traffic controller and he worked there. And he called my mom and he said, keep the boys home, that Kennedy's going to land at like 10:30 in the morning or something, because he was coming to Texas on this. It was a campaign swing is what it was. It was the beginning of his presidential campaign for reelection. He was dedicating the Brooks Army Medical Center in San Antonio, and I was there. That whole scene is built from my memories of being 8 years old and my mother taking me. And airports weren't like they are now. You could walk right up to the fence and watch the president land and wave, and we did all that.
So you saw Jackie, and were there people swooning over Jackie?
It was one of those things. I do remember that, and it's in the book. It was a very big deal for a Catholic president to come to town in San Antonio. It was a Catholic city. Catholicism is practiced in the modern world, and I think maybe in occupied Mexico, where I grew up, it is practiced largely by women on behalf of their men who sort of stop going to church when they become adults. They were much more impressed with Jackie than they were with Jack Kennedy himself. She was really kind of, they were both rock stars, but she was particularly a rock star, I think, to Catholic women in San Antonio.
Were you Catholic?
My mother was raised in the Catholic Church. My father was Methodist, and that's the church I was baptized in. My mother joined the Methodist Church, and then my father died 3 years ago. My mother went right back to the Catholic Church within 6 months after she buried him. It's kind of so. In some ways, I genetically am Catholic.
Steve Earle, there's sequences that take place in the Catholic Church involving priests. There's also comment made that they specifically look for Irish priests because they don't want to have the Mexican priests in there.
And that was true. There were almost no Hispanic priests that were pastors in the diocese at the time. And I went back and did the research. I knew some Catholic priests. My main area of activism is against the death penalty, and I'm kind of known for that. And I knew two or three born in Ireland Irish priests during the process of – I witnessed an execution, a guy called Jonathan Nobles in Texas. And his spiritual advisor – actually, I witnessed – one of the people that witnessed his execution along with me was a bishop from Ireland. And there was another Irish priest called Stephen Walsh who was involved. And I actually even borrowed his name at some point in this process. But – the Irish had a history of assimilating themselves politically in a way that I think maybe no other culture did. Catholics had a hard time. There was a really, really intense anti-Catholic sentiment in this country at one time, and the Irish had that to deal with. And the church was one area that they sort of – nowadays, the Archbishop in San Antonio is Hispanic. And the vast majority of the Catholics in the San Antonio, it's an archdiocese, and most of the members are Hispanic, so it makes sense. But it was a long time before that became true. And Ireland also, for three or four generations, was losing her best and brightest automatically to immigration. And one of the things that they were exporting, besides other, they were exporting priests all over the world. So there were a lot of Irish priests in Texas.
So it just jumped at you that would be an element in the book fairly early on then?
Yeah, and also I have this sort of affinity for the Irish in general. I think I can write. My priest is from Letterfreck because Letterfreck's at the end of the road in Connemara in Western Ireland. I spent a lot of time in Ireland and just because of the music. And it's back to write what you know. You know, I borrowed a lot of components of things that I felt like I could write about credibly because I've gotten near them in my life.
Well, I also noticed in listening to your latest album that there is kind of an Irish...
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. There always has been in my music. I mean, and I've recorded in Ireland with Sharon Shannon's band. And Sharon's like the best accordion player in Ireland. I don't think there's any, you know, doubt about that at this point in their life. But Irish traditional music has always been a big part of country music and different kinds of roots music in the United States. There's this thing of music that came from Ireland and Scotland and England, you know, to the United States with immigrants. And that's like a lot of things, a lot of really interesting music. You know, we are a country made up of components culturally from all over the world, and it's just part of that, you know, that dynamic.
Well, when you were writing I'll Never Get Out of This World Live, Steve Earle, were you listening to music at the same time?
Very little, because, I mean, I wrote a lot of the songs that are on the record during the time that I was working on, but when I was working on the book, I was pretty much working on the book. I can't listen to anything with lyrics, obviously, when I'm writing words.
Yeah.
So I will occasionally listen to instrumental bluegrass or instrumental Irish music or bebop when I'm writing. But it's dangerous because it dictates cadence. When I'm working out in the gym, I've gotten where I listen to audiobooks more than I do music, because I found I can consistently maintain the level of a workout. If the music slows down, then I slow down in my workout. And I find that to be less true when I listen to audiobooks. So I've always got a bunch of audiobooks on my iPod, so I can listen to them when I'm working out.
Well, when you're working on a book or short stories or your play, do you get this impression like, oh my God, put it all down, pick up the guitar and start?
It's happened. It's absolutely happened. Yeah. There's my first collection, my first book, there's a story called Tanny Town, which I actually mispronounced. The town in Maryland is actually pronounced Tiny Town, but I didn't know it at the time that I wrote it. How did it go? I wrote the song first, or a version of the song, and then I wrote the short story, the same title, same character, and then I had a little more developed character, so I went back and tweaked the song because I felt like there were things about the character that I decided. And that's the one instance where there is an album called El Corazon, there's a song called Tanny Town, and there's a short story of the same, that you're basically hearing the same story, one in the form of a song, one in the form of short fiction.
Which kind of brings up something that I had written here, which is that a lot of songwriters say that on some level, writing a song, writing the lyrics of a song, is like writing a story.
No, it is writing a story. Years ago, I lived in San Miguel Allende, and I knew several writers that wrote books and had written books, and some of them had written really good books, and one of them, I actually knew Clifford Irving, who had written a fake Howard Hughes biography,
right, yeah,
and was down there sort of hiding out. But he was a writer. He'd made his living as a writer for a long time, and he could write. You know, I've got an eighth grade education, and I didn't start writing anything besides songs until pretty late. I was, you know, I was like 40 when I started writing prose and writing poetry and writing plays and these other things that I write. And I used to sort of whine about, you know, well, I'll never be able to do that because of my lack of education, and, you know, what you do is really cool, and I suck. And I had more than one person tell me that maybe what I was doing was a more viable form of literature, you know, in the age that I was living in, you know, a more viable art form. I don't buy that because I really like to read, but, you know, it did dawn on me that the kind of songwriting I do, post-Bob Dylan songwriting, is literature that you can consume when you're driving your car, and it's a huge part of our culture in this country.
A lot of songs, not all songs, but a lot of songs actually have story in them.
No, they do. I mean, I learned, my mentor, I had two, Towns Van Zandt and Guy Clark, and Towns was more poetic, and he was into, and he wasn't like Dylan was into French poets and the Beats. Towns was into Robert Frost and Shakespeare. His poetic template was much more old school and much more conventional. He kind of thought in iambic pentameter. Guy Clark, who was a little older than Towns, but it just isn't as in awe of him as the rest of us were as Texas songwriters, what he writes is prose that happens to rhyme, and it's narrative with a beginning and a middle and an end. And that came more naturally to me. And I've written songs, you know, I wrote a song called Ben McCullough when I was 20 years old, which is about a real general in the Civil War who had been a Texas Ranger before the war, and he becomes a general and gets killed in the very first battle that he ever fought in. And, you know, there's lots of some stories that are completely and totally made up that I've written over the years. So for writing this, the challenge for me is to slow down. I'm pretty good at telling a complete tale in a really short period of time. When I have to slow down and make it into something that's a little longer, that's a challenge for me because I learned to do it the other way around.
Well, when you're writing prose, I mean, do you hear a beat and sometimes even a melody going on at the same time?
Yeah, I definitely hear a beat. I mean, I think my favorite writers are pretty musical in the way that they write. I love poetry. I think it's the purest form of this art of shoving words around. And I think poets that read their own work, I think there's a lot to be learned from doing that. I read every year at the Poetry Project Marathon at St. Mark's in New York. There's several of us that write a new poem for that every year. If I don't write a poem the rest of the year, I write one for that. You know, when I started acting, which was really late, I discovered that I knew more about acting than I thought I did from performing in front of audiences for years in my day job. And, you know, I went into it terrified and cold, and then I realized, oh, you know what? I do have some tools to bring to this that I've been using all along.
Well, what tools do you have then?
Well, it's just connecting with an audience. Whether there's, you know, a fourth wall or not, you still got to find the things that make people feel what you're feeling. I got a song called Little Rock and Roller. It was on my first record. Another song called Guitar Town. And on the surface, there's songs about, you know, something that I find really incredibly uninteresting, and that's feeling sorry for yourself because you're traveling down the road in the bus that costs more than most people's houses. But in both cases, those songs sort of survived and they succeed because I've had people that don't even realize I'm talking about the music business come up to me, truck drivers, people that somebody else is traveling for a living and they don't see their kids, they don't, you know. So that's what it becomes about. Art to me becomes about your own deepest personal experience, but the way you get an audience is by finding the parts of that that other people are going to be able to identify, the parts of it that are universal.
What I've found in talking to people, what grabs people the most sometimes is the most particularized.
Yeah, no, when you describe detail, and I think that's part of the craft part of it, when you learn to describe things accurately enough that people, oh, I felt that before, I smelled that before. I don't understand people that ride the subway in New York City with earbuds in, you know, because that's like rejecting input that I need to do my job. It's one of the reasons I moved to New York. You know, I've learned that about living there. I've always loved the city, and I moved there to breathe the same air as Tony Kushner. I moved there because I wanted to write plays and because I'm getting older and I think I need the input. I think I need the jolt. I need to be plugged into 220 instead of 110, which New York City definitely is.
The character of Doc is a junkie. Without knowing your past at that particular time and reading it, I realized that only one kind of person can really get into it that much. And let me ask you then, in writing those, how were you feeling? How hard can you get into it without having it overwhelm
danger,
you?
Danger of euphoric recall is what people worry about. 12-step programs are how I stay clean. I still, after 16 years, you know, 16 years last September, go to meetings, call my sponsor other people. I do all that stuff. I started this 8 years ago, so the way it affected me then was totally different than the way that it affected me by the time I finished it. And about a few weeks ago, I read the whole book. I probably would have been years before I read this. I worked so hard on it, and it was so hard. But I read my own audiobook. So I read the whole book in 3 days, and I kind of like it. That was one surprising thing. But you worry about that kind of stuff. But the fact of the matter is, I go to meetings specifically so people with very, very fresh memories of what's going on out there and what it's still like come in. I go to meetings partially to hear their stories. And I haven't heard anybody come in yet and say, hey, it's great out there. They got this whole new dope, and it's like it's a lot more fun than it used to be, and you don't get sick. Nobody's done that once in 16 years of going to meetings at least twice a week. So, you know, it's something I definitely thought about, and it makes me uncomfortable sometimes. But, you know, the passages in this book about addiction are pretty accurate, I think.
I have a couple of friends who are ex-junkies, and they've talked a little about
right.
it. And then reading it, I'm going, only someone who's experienced this right. could possibly write about it.
Yeah, it's hard. I don't know how anyone that had never experienced it would write about it in those terms. Because, I mean, I have to dwell on it quite a bit here, because when the book is about, you know, redemption to some point, it's about the idea that, you know, everybody seems kind of hopeless in the beginning of this book. I stopped reading Cormac McCarthy a few years ago, and I did it because he was bumming me out.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
I think there's probably no one on the planet that writes, you know, any better than he does. He's just obviously natural-born writer. And I read this stuff because everybody else was reading it, and I thought, yeah, this guy can really write. But I think your intentions count. Sometimes it's where if you're going to take me there – it doesn't even have to have a happy ending, but I gotta feel like it's worth it. And, you know, so it gets into, you know, I'm going to be much more likely to try to find something positive in the middle of all that negativity if I'm going to go there, because I kind of need to. I'm a recovering addict, not a using addict.
Well, what you do in the book is by bringing in Hank's ghost, we're taken out of it during those segments, and that itself brings us up.
I think Hank's ghost is like a... it's a really interesting character, and it's really important to remember that it's Hank's ghost. It's Hank Williams' ghost is a character in this book, not Hank Williams. You see very little, very, very vague recollections of what Hank was like when he was alive by both Hank and Doc. But the character you're dealing with has been dead for a while and has sort of sees the world that way through this a very, very limited, tiny world, because he kind of goes wherever Doc goes.
There's something that happens maybe partway through the beginning, but it happens after a while, which is that we've been looking at everything pretty much through Doc's eyes, third person, close third person,
right.
And suddenly, close third person, we're looking out through Hank Williams' eyes, and suddenly that changes it because Hank is a ghost. He's not Doc fantasizing.
Right. I tried to leave it to where you wondered about that in the beginning, but
right.
But it is resolved eventually. You know, there's a ghost in the book, and it's not... this book surprised me. I mean, I knew I was writing a book that was going to have Hank Williams' ghost in it almost immediately. But when it became about spirituality in this much broader sense that it becomes, and Hank's spirit is only, one of many manifestations of things that we talk about in terms of spirituality and things that are, quote, not natural, unquote, that surprised me. The Huckleberry Finn moment, you know, Huckleberry Finn, supposedly Twain had to stop, and he went out on a lecture tour and then came back and finished the book. He needed the money. He had to go on the road. And that happens to me. I had to stop several times in this book. But the point that happens in Huckleberry Finn is supposedly right where Jim and Huck are run over by the riverboat on the river. And after that, the book changes. And it becomes this thing that makes it once and for all no longer a sequel to The Adventures of Tom Sawyer and maybe the most important American novel it becomes at that point. It becomes this big, huge thing that made a lot of writers want to be writers, and it still fascinates me, and I still reread it. And I never reread Tom Sawyer. I mean, I read a lot of other Twain, but, you know, I've read Tom Sawyer more than once, but I read Huckleberry Finn over and over and over. There's this point at which it became something it didn't start out to be because
right.
of events that were actually occurring in the author's lives. And this book surprised me. I did not know how it was going to end until probably the last 6 or 7 weeks that I was working on it. I didn't know exactly how it was going to end. And I had a lot of questions to answer for myself, but I stopped. I thought at times I thought it was going to doom this book that I was having to stop and start and stop. So, and I don't recommend it. But in the long run, I think maybe it's a better book, especially considering it was my first novel and I was new at it. But I got a chance to stop and reread and look at what. And I changed editors in the middle because of
right.
one corporation eating another, things that are totally out of my control. And one thing recovery will teach you is that you don't control everything, and that sometimes you just have to deal with what you've got. And I'm actually okay with the way that it turned out. And I think it might even be a better book because I had to stop it and start it so many times.
You do get a sense about halfway through the book that there's suddenly direction.
Yeah.
I mean, it's moving along, but there's suddenly direction.
Yeah, it's going somewhere,
yeah. One other area I'd like to talk about the book, and then I want to ask you about your acting career a little bit. And that's the abortion issue. Now,
right.
you've said that abortion is a very difficult issue because on the one hand, it's taking a life, but on the other hand, men shouldn't be telling women what to do with their bodies.
Right. Because of playing music, I couldn't play places when I was 14, 15, 16 years old that served liquor. So that I went to coffee houses. That's where I could get in and play. My upbringing was finished by people 5 to 10 years older than me that were hippies. The local coffee house was in the same building as the local underground newspaper in San Antonio. And I learned, about that there was a movement against the Vietnam War. And I learned about Jack Kerouac. And I learned about Allen Ginsberg. And I learned about a lot of the things that make me, in that setting. And everything that I do, is colored by that. And I had some personal experience.
But when you were 14, right?
When I was 14 and 15 years old, these people were mostly older than me. And then I got my girlfriend pregnant when we were both 14 years old. And this is Texas. So in 1969, when I was 14 years old, abortion was illegal, I'm pretty sure, in every state except for New York State. I think that's right. But I think, because I remember people by the time I was in high school going to New York to get abortions. I remember people talking about that. Now, I've talked to people that grew up outside of Texas and outside the Southwest that used to hear that you could go to Mexico and get an abortion. It was just like an old wives' tale, because you can get an abortion in Mexico. It's a Catholic country. It's not going to happen. And probably along the border, maybe on both sides in back alleys, there were certainly abortions available. And I think that's where that idea came from. But my girlfriend, when she got pregnant when she was 14 and I was 14, got an abortion in a hospital in San Antonio, Texas, illegally, because her father was a clinical psychologist and he worked at a hospital. And it was written up as a DNC. The point is, politically, you know, I don't make political art almost. I almost never make it on purpose. I have done it. I mean, I wrote Jerusalem, that song's political art on purpose, as emotional as it is. You know, John Walker's Blues is political art on purpose. But I don't do it that when I die, they're going to figure out I wrote as many songs about girls as I did anything else. But my girlfriend managed to get an abortion because of who she was. And the fact is, in this country, doctors and lawyers and people that are off, their daughters could always get abortions when they needed to. And it's always been, but this issue's always been about people without means and whether they had access to that same procedure that women get, that women get abortions. Now, I'm opposed to the death penalty. Do I think that an abortion is taking a life? Yes, I do. But I still am not comfortable with large bodies of men deciding what. I mean, I was raised on Emma Goldman. There's not any doubt about it, and it kind of stuck.
Well, what if the Senate was composed of women?
I don't think we'd be having this conversation. I think that would be like, it wouldn't, and I probably wouldn't have ever even written this book.
I keep looking through your songs and this book, and what I see is that you talk about there not being that much in the way of politics except for specific songs. But on the other hand, the book is also focuses on class.
Absolutely.
And on race. And on race.
Sure,
racism.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I'm not saying that there isn't politics in everything I do. I'm a really political person. You know, I'm a socialist. You know, I'm an absolutely unapologetic socialist. I believe everything that Karl Marx said about economics. I don't often quote Condoleezza Rice, but I heard her say something really, really smart once, and that was that America suffers from a birth defect, and that is slavery. It's a huge part of who we are. We almost exist as, and this figures into some of the background in this story as well, we almost exist as a place that, after slavery was outlawed in Europe, these colonies were formed basically so slavery could be practiced offshore for a few more generations, so the second and third and fourth sons of people that already had money could make their fortunes. And it's a huge part of who we are.
Outsourcing slavery.
Yeah.
There's a thought.
No, absolutely. That's totally what happened.
Steve Earle, you said in reading the book aloud for the audio version, you said, well, I kind of like it. What about when you listen to your music? Is that generally your thing, or do you go, I nailed it?
I've said I nailed it before. You know, it's embarrassing how much I like to listen to my own music. I don't have a record that I'm ashamed of. There's some things that make me uncomfortable that I wish I had back. But, you know, I think art is, you know, some of this is being a person in recovery. It's a big part of who I am. I have to let things go. But I think that effectiveness as an artist is enhanced by the ability to breathe life into something and then let it go and just go on and make something else. I feel sorry for friends of mine that labor and labor and labor over records and can't decide that they're finished, because it's called a record for a reason, whatever format it's sold in. It's a record of a given performance at an instant in time, and I really sort of think of all art that way.
Well, I was talking with Jacques D'Amboise, who was a dancer for the New York City Ballet, and he said every time he went out, it was both his first performance and his last. So in that sense, if you're not happy, with anything that you've done on the record, you're going to be on tour and you could do what you want with it.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's one thing I love, I think, about live theater. The last few years, what I do in New York City is I spend money on two things, baseball, well, guitars. I'm a degenerate guitar collector. But as far as stuff I go out to do in New York City, in the greatest city in the world, I go see baseball and I go to live theater, you know. And it's like I heard Richard Eyre, you know, like speaking at the Public Theater about 10 years ago, and he was talking about this book on the, it was one of those books that was published in the millennium, you know, about theater, and it was his take on the history of theater as a person running the National Theater in London. And he told this analogy of Michelangelo's snowman, and it was addressing why theater, live theater, is so important. And it's basically a legend that it snowed in Florence, and it didn't snow in Florence very much, and Michelangelo made a sculpture out of snow. And, you know, it's Florence, so it melted. And people that saw it, you know, which is probably, you know, one Medici or another, you know, and four or five people that saw it said it was the most beautiful thing that he ever did, but you had to be there. And, and any kind of live performance, is that's one of the beauties of it, is you've got to be there.
Have you ever thought about writing a musical?
I have. I've got interested in it. I didn't think about it for a long time. I've written one play, and I'm working on another play now. The play I'm working on now is sort of a musical. It's like a performance piece for one performer and mixed media, sort of like talk radio was, and it's sort of patterned out there. But it's called Dangerous Songs, and it's about Pete Seeger's testimony before HUAC in 1955. So it's full of Pete Seeger music. It's based on the idea of Pete took the first, not the Fifth Amendment, like the Hollywood 10 did. He just basically said, you're asking me about my political affiliations, which you have no right to do. In other words, it's like walking into the voting booth with you, and you're not supposed to have to do that. But he did offer constantly, if you read the transcript, and it's hilarious, he offers over and over again to sing for them and play, and which they never happens. And the idea of the piece is, what if Pete had sung when he was testifying before HUAC in 1955? So I love really great musicals, and I think I don't think we've seen a ton of them the last, you know, few decades. And I love Carousel. You know, I think it's really beautiful and dark, and I think it's great theater. I've seen a couple of things recently. One is Carolyn or Change, Tony Kushner's musical, which was pretty breathtaking. And I liked Spring Awakening. I thought it was really, really good, and maybe for the first time that rock music was successfully integrated into a real book musical. And so I've gotten sort of encouraged by that, and I have thought about it. I haven't done I suggested to my agent that maybe I might get my feet wet by writing lyrics for a musical that somebody else that does that, you know, was doing or something, you know, rather than because whether I'm not quite ready to dive in and write the book and the lyrics and the music for a musical, but I've become interested in it a little bit in the last few years.
Well, there's a problem with doing too much. It's what happened to Paul Simon on The Cape Man, is that he got completely lost in what he wanted to do and forgot that he's in theater.
Yeah, he did. But you know what? There have been recent performances of The Cape Man that he went back and he worked on it. And you know what? It got really, really good reviews this time. So, you know, you learn from that. I think it's a hard thing. He's a writer that really likes to write and write and write and write. He's very happy to write and rewrite things over and over again. And you can lose your way. He's also one of the writers that when somebody younger asked me who they should be listening to figure out how to write songs, I mean, he can rhyme consonants. He's the bridge between Tin Pan Alley and Greenwich Village. He was one of the last writers to learn to write songs in the Brill Building, but he was around when Dylan came along and made, you know, his career as a, you know, as a singer-songwriter, you know, is post-Dylan, and he's really, really one of the best songwriters that's ever breathed.
Steve Earle, how did you get into acting? How did you know David Simon?
Well, he knew me David Simon's a music freak, and he's used a lot of music, going back to Homicide, you know, which he helped create. It's based on a book of his, Homicide, Life on the Streets. I turned down a lot of acting roles when I was a lot better looking than I am now in the 80s and up into the 90s. But I never I just didn't do anything but write songs. I didn't think I should be doing any, you know, getting out of this area where I knew I was pretty good. In recovery again, I started thinking about things differently, and I started doing these other things, writing books, writing poems. I wrote a haiku a day for a year at one point, and, you know, even painting a little bit. Just discovered that going into other disciplines could strengthen my home-based craft if I did them. I could learn things from doing that. And meanwhile, you know, when The Wire – actually, it began with The Corner. David used a song of mine in a miniseries called The Corner for, that he did for HBO directly before The Wire. It's almost related to The Wire. It's set in the same part of Baltimore. He used a song of mine called South Nashville Blues as the theme. He had Corey Harris re-record it and change it slightly so it was set in Baltimore rather than Nashville. And then he suddenly called my manager and said he created this character that he thought I might he'd like for me to read for if I was interested. I read it, and it was a redneck recovering addict, and that didn't require any acting, so it didn't intimidate me very much. So I read for it in a recording studio in Nashville, and he hired me. So I flew to Baltimore, and David Simon picked me up at the airport, and he took me on the Hattie Carroll tour. David's a crime writer. That's what he did. He covered crime for the Baltimore Sun for years, and he knew where all of the sites were involved in the whole story around Bob Dylan's The Lonesome Death of Hattie Carroll. So we went directly from the airport on the Hattie Carroll tour. And then we went to a baseball game, and then I got up the next day and shot my first episode of The Wire. And I was in it. Whenever Bubbles decided to get clean, I would pop up and for the off and on for the 5 years. And then Treme came along, which Treme is a little different because I do get to sing in Treme. It doesn't require any more acting. I'm playing me if I'd never gotten a record deal. I play a busker. I play a street singer called Harley Watt. The name comes from a character in my collection of short fiction. I got to name my own character. So he's one of my characters that's really heavily based on me in one of my short stories. And it's a blast. As an actor, it's still about writing. As an actor, I've only said words that were written by David Simon, you know, and Eric Overmyer and Richard Price. And, you know, I did one feature which was written and directed by Tim Blake Nelson. When you go out and say words written by people like that, you get to be a better writer. And that's the main reason that I did it.
How many takes do you need on these things?
It's never up to me. It's like I try to learn my lines and not bump into things, like they say. But, you know, early on, I was really uncomfortable doing it, but people were really patient with me. I've gotten to work with really great directors too. I've worked with you know, Agnieszka Holland 3 times. Actors love to work with Agnieszka. Crews don't like it all that much because she shoots until there's no film left for 3 surrounding counties. And you know, I heard her, you know, talking to Nina Noble, one of the producers. I just overheard a conversation one day, and she goes, "I can shoot it over here, and master, or I can shoot it good. Which one do you want?" You know, they were just trying to get her to hurry up. Because she goes into it not necessarily knowing how many setups she's going to do. And she changes her mind. But crews, it drives them crazy because it wears them out and they have to work with her. Actors, when you see it cut together, when it's done, she makes you look like a genius. So actors really love working with her.
Well, she also came out of kind of art films. I mean, you know, she
made Europa Europa.
Yeah, exactly.
It was a great movie.
She came out of a completely different world than the TV director.
Yeah, I think right now, this kind of television, this kind of cable television is kind of where the art is. And there's a lot of reasons for that. There are people that write plays, you know, want to be playwrights that live in New York City that are writing, you know, dramas and comedies for HBO and Showtime because there's no commercials. You can cuss. You can do whatever you want to do. And you can write about things that you couldn't write about on network television. So it's a pretty amazing, you know, like a fertile area for, you know, for art making right now in this
country. Well, that's what I'm finding out talking to writers. That I used to say to them, "What's Hollywood doing?" And they go, "Well, you know, with a movie, screw it, you know, whatever happens, happens. But what I'm interested in is the long form on television,"
yeah.
And that's what
it's
I'm focused
very,
on.
It's a very, very cool thing. And people dig it. People, The Wire and Treme, because of the way David does it, more people have seen it on DVD, and it'll continue to be that way because it's a lot to absorb as it goes by each week. And so most people have to see things more than once. I think I'm still watching Deadwood, and I'm a huge fan of John from Cincinnati. I think David Milch is a real live, thinks an iambic pentameter genius. You know, the difference between Milch and a big difference between him and David Simon is David Simon is always within budget and always on time. He's very, very economical, and boy, he writes his ass off. You don't necessarily have to have, you know, great ratings. That's another area. But if people realize there is an audience out there, it doesn't have to be the audience, and so you don't have to, you know, put a naked vampire in everything.
Steve Earle, what was it like getting two biographies and one documentary just about you?
Well, the documentary I was sort of involved in because Amos Poe made it. He's a friend of mine. It was made by my record label. And so that was a little more shooting my own self in the foot. I mean, there was another documentary that was made about me that I pulled the plug on about halfway through just because the guy who was an Academy Award winner, but he broke several rules that were laid out in the beginning and finally ended up with him sticking a camera in Neil Young's face backstage at Farm Aid, and that was that. The plug got pulled and the documentary didn't get finished. The biographies I've never read. And if there was a book that big about you, my suggestion to you is that you don't read it either. I just don't read reviews very much. I have to read them when it comes to theater. And I've seen most of the reviews for the book because my editor keeps sending it to me. My records, I just don't even do it anymore. I mean, why? What's the point? It's not going to change what I'm going to do on my next record. I'm not looking for input when it comes to what I'm going to do on my next record from anybody but my audience. And, you know, and I'm right about that sometimes. I'm wrong about it sometimes. And you know, reviews are like bad enough. It's like, you know, if they don't like you, it hurts your feelings. If they like you, you end up being, you know, that's not good for you either. Somebody asked me if this book was an autobiography, and I said, no, why would I screw myself out of material like that? That just seems like a real bonehead move for anybody that's intending on making any more art for the rest of their life.
Steve Earle, I would guess that you haven't heard from Hollywood about this one, or is someone interested?
It would be a tough one to make. You know, I thought about the other day that maybe the long form on television might be, you know, a way to start. You know, it might be a basis for starting something like that. You know, it's kind of turned into a Harry Potter book for adults on me, you know, so it's a lot of stuff going on. It wouldn't be a cheap movie. You wouldn't be able to make this book effectively without spending some money on it. I've had two short stories optioned. One option keeps getting renewed, and that's how most writers make a living from Hollywood, is they get stories optioned over and over and over again, and the films never get made. You know, Jim Carroll had sort of a cottage industry going on, you know, optioning the Basketball Diaries for years, and then the movie that got made, you know, he wasn't particularly happy with. It's a tough thing, so you just don't worry about it. I'll option it to somebody if they approach me, and I don't want to be a screenwriter, and I don't want to be a producer, but we'll see what happens. I mean, it's one of those things you never can. I've got a one-year-old son and a wife that's 17 years younger than me, so I'm not going to say no to anything without hearing what people have to say.
You've now got this album, I'll Never Get Out of This World Alive. On your website, there's mention of another album called Towns.
Towns was my last record, which was a record of Towns Van Zandt songs.
And that came out a year ago? Or?
It's been 2 years ago. It was me finally making an entire record, first time I ever made a record of someone else's material. But he's the reason I do this. I named my oldest son after him, and I think he's the best songwriter that I knew growing up.
Well, Steve Earle, I'm going to ask the question I ask all writers. Have you started work on something else?
I'm working on a play called Dangerous Songs. I swore, halfway through this, I'd never, ever write another novel again, but there's already another idea, but I'm not ready to talk about it yet.
You've been listening to an interview with Steve Earle, whose latest book and latest album are both titled I'll Never Get Out of This World Alive. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.